Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Resistance to Donald Trump has been a battle cry, but Democrats know they need more than that as they line up for 2018 elections and beyond. Yesterday, they unveiled their new push. They call it a better deal. The Democratic Party's appeal to voters that they've got the better economic offering. This hour, On Point, checking out the Democrats' better deal. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this the right stuff for the Democrats, for you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Whole lot of Democrats about an hour west of Washington yesterday in Berryville, Virginia. Chuck Schumer was right there in the middle of it, Democrat Senate leader. Here he was saying that voters need more from Democrats.
Too many Americans don't know what we stand for. Not after today. President Trump campaigned on a populist platform, talking to working people. That's why he won. But as soon as he got into office, he abandoned them.
Okay, and what do Democrats have to offer? Chuck Schumer said, with references to Teddy Roosevelt's Square Deal and FDR's New Deal, now a better deal.
We Democrats are offering a better deal, a phrase that intentionally evokes the New Deal, because we can afford to go back to those times. We cannot afford to go back to those times. The American people deserve an economy that works for them, not for the powerful. A better deal is not just our slogan. It is our mission. It's about reorienting government to work on behalf of people and families.
Okay, more Schumer there. And here he was saying, look, we've taken some losses, and of course, it's part our fault. The Democrat, Chuck Schumer, this was on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
It is in part our fault. When you lose an election with someone who has, say, 40% popularity, you look in the mirror and say, what did we do wrong? And the number one thing that we did wrong is we didn't tell people what we stood for. Even today, as your poll showed, they know we're standing up to Trump. They like that. But they want to know, what do you stand?
Yesterday, Democrats came out to announce what they now stand for. Let's look at what that is, what it might mean politically. Joining me first today from Washington is David Weigel, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What's in the deal? The better deal, as they've dubbed it.
Well, it's a combination of all economic ideas. It's antitrust, which is the newest and most exciting thing from the left perspective. It's expanding the current healthcare system that exists, the one that we'll see how much of it exists after this week, but probably still most of it. It's basically, as I think Vice was first to notice, a lot of Hillary Clinton's 2016 platform, except one more populist, more progressive, for example, four times as much infrastructure spending, and then also it's not tied to Hillary Clinton. So the theory is there's a lot that was left on the floor in 2016 because of the character focus of the campaign. Democrats without a leader might be in better shape to just run around an agenda instead of a personality.
So they're talking here about 10 million more jobs. Of course, easy number to throw out, but nevertheless, 10 million jobs over 5 years with apprenticeship programs and tax credits for employers who provide on-the-job training. 10 million more jobs building a whole lot of infrastructure, four times what Hillary had in mind, you say?
Well, she was more like a quarter of $1 trillion, and Democrats have matched. They've been doing this all year, actually. A lot of this incorporates what they've said before. They have taken what the president's talked about occasionally as a trillion-dollar infrastructure spending program and proposed their own, which would be all, you know, tax and deficit financed, as opposed to the public-private sort of unicorn that has yet to be born from the Trump administration. They also incorporate the $15 minimum wage, which was not the party's majority position even 9 months ago, and has been since really the spring. Again, they've been doing a lot of things that, much like House Republicans will complain about, they're trying to do a lot of things that just don't get attention because of who the president is and the way the fights of the political day shake out. And so they're trying to cohere because they know they stand for things. They know they ran on things. They frankly know that, you know, they had 8 years of the White House that didn't go too badly for the country, but no one will listen to them. So this was an attempt mostly to get people to listen to what they've been saying already.
Trying to break through. One of the places they want to break through is on prescription drugs. You talked about health care, but here they want to control drug costs. This hits a lot of Americans in the pocketbook. What are Democrats saying they want to do about it?
Well, that's in the plan. That's just cheap reimportation. Basically, again, what Bernie Sanders has been arguing for, which is just using Medicare to negotiate these drug prices and then making it easier to reimport them from other countries for cheaper. Again, like a goal Democrats have had for a while, kind of stymied, especially when Barack Obama was president and Republicans ran Congress. But now that they don't have power, something that they're going to shoot the moon for.
And then cracking down on monopolies and big corporate mergers that harm consumers. This is sort of a new focus. I mean, we know it's been out there, but what are they going after exactly?
Well, they were hit really since the first month of the Obama administration with the idea that they protected big business as much or more than Republicans. It's what they believe is a extremely effective con that has been run on voters, that because Hillary Clinton also got some money from Goldman Sachs and got some money from energy industry employees that Democrats are as pro-corporation as Republicans, they've realized, and even Chuck Schumer, who represents New York, has realized that's untenable. So in selling this, it's not just that the party is going saying in power they're going to be stricter on monopolies. I mean, one merger they're complaining about right now is the St. Clair buying Tribune Media, which is turning a lot of TV stations into more conservative stations, basically because the Trump administration waived a rule against companies buying too many stations. They're against bigness in general, and it was interesting when Chuck Schumer set up this platform over the weekend. He apologized basically for Democrats approving the ExxonMobil merger. That is a shift. That's a leftward shift that began in 2016, but it's really accelerated now, where if they're out of power and they can't count on that money to fund their party anymore, they're going to say, in power, we're going to deliver on these populist reforms in the way that they haven't before. I mean, the pattern has been Bill Clinton wins, and then Republicans take power and they soften on corporate issues. Barack Obama wins, same pattern, especially starting with TARP. And they're saying, we're not going to do that again. We're going to be the Teddy Roosevelt populist party.
Senator Elizabeth Warren there in Berryville, Virginia, yesterday railing against corporate concentration.
Giant corporations jack up prices and cut corners on quality. This matters because giant corporations put the squeeze on wages. As profits have gone up, wages for American workers have gone down.
David Weigel is following all this for The Washington Post. David, what's the ratio of, if it's, you know, some parts Clinton and some parts Sanders, has the ratio changed in the better deal rolled out yesterday? Have Democrats moved more toward the Bernie Sanders a prescription for the country, or stuck with the more centrist Clinton formula? What's the direction here?
Well, yes, although I think it's the center is a very misapplied term in politics, and I think they've finally started to appreciate that when you've got Donald Trump as president and you've got Senate Republicans breaking every norm that they used to stand for in order to change a health care bill that was built to be bipartisan. It wasn't bipartisan, it was built to be bipartisan. Fewer Democrats are orienting themselves around the idea that the center is a good thing. The center itself is a place that they should reach. And they also feel, this is not in the plan, but this informs it, there's a sense that the party made at least rhetorical compromises in 2016 with this deal they offered voters. It was Hillary Clinton ran on a progressive platform, especially on guns and the environment, et cetera, but at the same time was telling Republican suburban voters and independents, come on, Trump is ridiculous. We need a president for all people, and just this once you can cross party lines. And not that many Republicans did so. In some suburbs, yes, but obviously she did worse. And so there is a new sense that, one, the center by itself is not worth approaching politically, and two, that they need to excite their base more than they need to win the reluctant Republican voter. That election, to many of them, proved you can't. You need to outvote them. That's the reason why, when in power, Republican Republicans like Chris Kobach, who knows the vice chair of the voting commission, while they look for ways to make it tougher for poor people to vote. They're just saying we need to turn out more poor people, more of our base, convince more. The people they want to convince are more like the kind that will be in Youngstown when the president arrives there, people who were promised jobs coming back for people with specific skills, used to high unionized wages. If they're not getting delivered on, they're going to appeal to them, but they're not so much going to appeal to the kind of the David Brooks centrist the way that they did for 2016.
And we've seen the polls out lately saying that Americans see Democrats as opposing Donald Trump, but more than half, but fewer than half, 30-some percent, said the Democrats stood for something. Is this their attempt to lay out, here's what we stand for?
Yeah. Well, yeah, two things about that. One is they really do have trouble getting attention paid to them. And it's not that unusual for an out-of-power party, but it's extremely intense now. I mean, for example, they yesterday released this. It is a big deal. It's within the D.C. media driving distance, and it is not carried on any network because Jared Kushner's reading a prepared statement, and then cable news channels are going in to cover what Jared Kushner said and having discussion of it. So they are aware that even when they stand for things, voters accuse them of not doing anything because they don't hear about it. And they found this in focus groups, too. I mean, the scariest thing they found is recently is a lot of under 30 voters who attitudinally are basically 4-1 against Donald Trump. They're the kind of people who are inclined to say, well, Trump's bad, but I don't hear anything from the Democrats. And they've been kind of shouting in the darkness saying, no, we do have this gigantic agenda. We ran about it. The only person that gets any pickup at all in that climate is Bernie Sanders. But they have not figured out how to crack in the way that Republicans can. I think Republicans have proven that they're very effective at using targeted media to tell their voters, hey, we stand for these things. Come out and vote, even if you're frustrated with the president.
David, do you see unity within the Democratic Party political ranks here around this better deal?
Yeah, more than I expected, frankly.
David Weigel with The Washington Post reporting on the latest from the Democrats trying to get people's attention. Not the square deal, not the new deal, but a better deal. They rolled it out yesterday. We're going to look at it. David Weigel, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, it's Tom. Before we get back to the show, I wanted to tell you to be sure and stay with us till the very end of this podcast for a preview of Freak Out and Carry On. It's WBUR's new podcast that addresses today's politics through a historical lens. Give it a listen, and thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Democrats rolling out a new presentation, a new appeal to American voters. They are calling it a better deal. Rolled it out yesterday in Berryville, Virginia, about an hour west of Washington, D.C. Contest there that they are getting invested in, but contest across the country. They know they need to win if they want any chance of turning around a house or two on Capitol Hill. Looking forward to 2020 and the White House. Democrats trying to roll out something new here. Here was Chuck Schumer the day before their big rollout on ABC's This Week saying, hey, we were too cautious. He said, namby-pamby.
We were too cautious. We were too namby-pamby. This is sharp, bold, and will appeal to both the old Obama coalition, let's say the young lady who's just getting out of college, and the Democratic voters who deserted us for Trump, the blue-collar worker.
Some may wonder.
Economics, George, is our strength.
Some may wonder if it's going to
be. We are going to go at it.
Economics is our strength. We're going to go back at it. And here he was at their rollout yesterday in Virginia.
We are here today to tell the people of Berryville and the working people of America, someone has your back.
Chuck Schumer with the rollout. You can join us this hour. What do you see? Do you like what Democrats are offering here? More infrastructure, more jobs, better pay, reining in drug prices, reining in corporate power, monopolies. Does it sound more like a Bernie Sanders platform? Are you good with that? And where did Democrats go wrong, lose their majorities? Will this fix it? With us right now from Setauket, New York, is Stephanie Kelton, economics professor at Stony Brook University. She was one of the consultants on the new Better Deal policy agenda, a former economic advisor to Bernie Sanders. Stephanie Kelton, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Hi, Tom.
Hi. And with us today from San Francisco is Steve Phillips, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's been writing recently, had an op-ed in the New York Times saying the Democratic Party's billion-dollar mistake, looking back to coalitions, which are not so evident. Coalition building, he said, and bringing out the minority vote, still very important, not so front and center in a better deal. Steve Phillips in San Francisco, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Stephanie Kelton, if you wanted to sit someone down, we heard it from Dave Weigel, but let's hear it from you. Somebody who's interested and they're saying, all right, what do you have on tap here? What do you have on offer in a better deal? How would you describe the main planks of it?
Well, I think the main planks are that, people have been given a raw deal, for lack of a better way of putting it, and that the Democrats recognize that they understand that everything is not okay, that people have been working very hard. They don't feel like they're getting ahead. Their bills are too high. Their pay is too low. They feel like no matter how hard they try, they can't get ahead. They're living in a rigged economy. They think the big guys have too much power and influence in Washington. The Democrats understand that. And what they're saying now is that, look, for too long, Washington has been looking out for not the little guy, but the big guy and for themselves. And that's ending. And what they're going to do now is start to look out for the little guy. And they're going to come forward with a message and an agenda that says we're going to take seriously the challenges that are holding back the middle class and those who are really struggling to get into it.
Is that a Bernie Sanders line? Is it a Hillary Clinton line? Is it a new melding of the two, Stephanie?
You know, it's funny. It's almost everything, right? I mean, you heard it in part from Hillary Clinton. You certainly heard it from Bernie Sanders. And of course, you also heard it from Donald Trump. This is the guy who said, America is not okay. Help is on the way. Better days ahead. And that resonated. And I think Democrats watched Senator Sanders with a very similar message, different diagnosis for sure, and different policy prescriptions. But at the end of the day, both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump were saying to the American worker, we get it, you're hurting, and we're going to do something about that pain you're feeling.
Steve Phillips in San Francisco, I mean, here they've got a $15 an hour minimum wage in here, a crusade against big monopolies. We heard Elizabeth Warren say those are driving up prices and driving down wages, a push to lower prescription drug costs. That hits a lot of people in the pocketbook. 10 million more jobs, we're told, a lot of infrastructure spending here. And yet you've got your misgivings about this. Why, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, it's fine as far as it goes, but the current plans won't work because it's focused on the wrong problem and it's based on an incorrect analysis. And even the fact that they launched this in Clark County, that's a 86% white county that voted overwhelmingly for Trump, as mm-hmm. well as voted overwhelmingly for Romney, proving that you can win in Virginia without that county. It's not focused on reassembling the Obama coalition and bringing out particularly the African-American voters who didn't vote in 2016 and bringing back the voters who voted for Johnson and Stein, who defected and lowered the progressive vote to a level which Trump was able to actually prevail. This plan is premised on the concept that the way to back to power is to actually change the minds of people who voted for Trump and win them back. And that's not the way to actually go back winning power. And that's not, there's very little empirical evidence that that is possible. And all this talk about, you know, the populism and the economic, you know, anxiety, people are not appreciating or recognizing or validating that Trump rose to power by demonizing Mexicans and Muslims. And there was a nationalist and a fostering of racial resentment. And that's the core of his appeal. And so what you're not hearing from the Democrats is actually standing up for those who have been demonized. The level of increased deportations and immigration policy, where they're rounding up people and disrupting families, is immoral and outrageous, and yet you don't hear an outcry. There's a large increase in violence against Muslims and other minority groups, and you don't hear a large outcry about that.
Yeah.
And that's because they're afraid of alienating those Trump voters. So the strategic underpinnings are incorrect and faulty, and that's what my concern is.
Stephanie Kelton, does this plan, with its focus on economics, and Steve Phillips says, you know, kind of focus on winning back Trump voters, does it walk away from the big tent Democratic coalition across all kinds of sectors idea?
Well, I hope it doesn't. I mean, I think it's certainly true that we would expect to hear Democrats standing up in the ways that were just described for a variety of things. This is narrowly an economic agenda at this point. And I think it's also clear that this is intended to be just the beginning. This isn't the full agenda. This is the start. And what the Democrats have said is that we're going to be rolling out additional programs, policies, features in the coming weeks and months. And so I expect a number of things to become part of this broader agenda. But at this point, you know, it really was designed to address what are viewed as the economic challenges facing the middle class.
But is it premised on winning back Trump voters?
Well, I don't think it's just premised on winning back Trump voters, but I do think that the crossover voter, you know, Democrats want back those voters that voted twice for President Obama and then became a Trump voter in 2016. And so what they're trying to do is, I think, recognize that some of the complaints that those voters have about the way that this economy is working are legitimate, and that the Democrats are willing to stand up and to fight for them. And, you know, who's looking out for me? And the Democrats want to be the party that is looking out for the little guy. So when Donald Trump went out and in these communities that have been torn by monopolies, that have crushed small businesses and decimated communities by trade deals and so forth, he's saying, no, the Democrats are saying, we're going to reverse engineer those things. We're going to stand up. We're going to fight against those concentrations of power. We're going to fight against the big monopoly interests that are destroying communities, suppressing wages, and making it more difficult for workers to find good jobs and so forth. So that's got to be part of this.
Let's hear from our listeners across the country. Art in Smyrna, South Carolina. Art, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you hear? What do you think?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Well, what I think is that there are too many underinformed and uninformed angry voters that are easily manipulated by people like Rush Limbaugh or Fox News. And it's not so much a question of policy, it's a question of the delivery. If you listen to Obama speak on any subject and then listen to Trump speak on any subject, the Republicans are now and have for a long time selling anger and hate. And the Democrats are trying to sell logic and reason and anger. And besides that, a lot of Democrats don't get themselves out to vote, which is really a big problem.
So
they're not inspired.
What are you suggesting, that they talk like Donald Trump, or they come out with this kind of new package?
Well, I don't think it has to be talk like Donald Trump. And I don't know how they get people to be critical thinkers. We don't have a lot of critical thinkers. If Rush Limbaugh has an enormous audience and Fox News has an enormous audience, how many critical thinkers are there? I mean, there aren't.
Art, let us hold that critical thought right there, and I appreciate your call from Smyrna. I want to get one more from Jefferson City, Missouri. Keith, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just had one question. Yep. I hear the Democrats saying that they're fighting against big corporations. They're not fighting for they're not working for big money now. But I wonder if they actually believe that people are going to buy that when they still don't fight for campaign finance reform, when they still take money from these giant corporations. That was the big knock on Hillary Clinton during the election, that she had all that money in her pocket. And it was shown that extra money didn't win her the election.
So you are skeptical about the distancing from corporate power that we heard is embedded in here with an attack on monopolies. We heard Elizabeth Warren talking about that. Let us look at that as well. Steve Phillips, stand by, and Stephanie Kelton. Michael Sandel joins us right now, professor of political philosophy at Harvard, He's been writing about all this, the state of resistance. His piece in Democracy Journal was headlined. What's needed now are priorities and an affirmative political project. Michael Sandel, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
So you hear skepticism right out of the gate there. First of all, that this is going to land on American political consciousness and that there's an informed consciousness out there from South Carolina, from Missouri, that skepticism about Democrats being effectively distancing themselves from the corporate power they're criticizing here. What's your take on this new rollout, the better deal? Is this the prescription?
It's a very small step in the right direction because it shows that the Democrats understand they have to offer an affirmative political vision.
Not just resistance.
Not just resistance. But what it doesn't offer is a vision. It doesn't offer broad governing themes, and it doesn't reflect an understanding of what the populist revolt on the right with Trump and on the left with Bernie was about. It assumes that the populist protest was mainly about economics, about jobs, wages, and prices. And I think that's a fundamental misreading of what we've seen.
But surely that's in there. I mean, a lot of people really took a hit in the Great Recession. People hadn't had wage growth for a long time. People saw their sort of standing in the economy slip and slide. That stuff's economic.
Yes, it is, and that's all an important part of it. But the potent part of Trump's appeal and also of Bernie's appeal was that they spoke to the anger and resentment of people who felt that the economy and also the culture had left them behind. The traditional mission of the Democratic Party or of progressive social democratic parties in general is to tame capitalism and to hold economic power to democratic account.
Mm-hmm.
And over the last few decades, the Democratic Party basically gave up on this mission. It cast its lot. And this was a bipartisan mainstream political undertaking with a version of market-driven globalization.
You're going back to the Bill Clinton years.
Right. Deregulating the financial industry, embracing global trade agreements whose benefits flowed to those at the top but left ordinary people feeling disempowered. And when the inequality grew as a result of the globalization, that project, Democrats didn't really have much to say about that inequality. And when the power of money—
A lot of their most vocal party members were doing quite well with that.
They were. And the Democratic Party, as a result, became more congenial to the professional classes than to ordinary working people and middle-class voters who were their traditional constituency. The other thing they failed to do was to address seriously the problem, the growing power of money in politics. These, I think, are the deeper sources of the populist upsurge on the right and on the left. And the agenda that the Democrats put forward about jobs and wages, those are worthy policies. Who could object? But they don't address these larger sources of discontent.
Stephanie Kelton, do you achieve here with a better deal that kind of fundamental realignment around a different set of interests that might not be those who prospered in the globalizing years?
Well, I think that, you know, I have to agree. I don't think I could have said it any better. I think that what we have to see if we're going to actually achieve a better deal for workers is a rebalancing of the economy. That means making the system, the economic system itself, more equitable. And to the extent that that's lacking in what has been laid out in this first iteration of the better deal, that's going to be a problem in terms of how meaningfully the Democrats are going to be able to achieve the kinds of things that they, you know, rhetorically say that they're working to advance here.
Do you have to bite into the livelihoods of that professional class, which has gravitated to the Democratic Party, in order to stem that inequities you're talking about?
Yeah, because you have to make a clean break. I mean, this is what we're hearing is that the neoliberal agenda that, you know, this experiment that was run, not just on the American people, but globally, this experiment that was run over the course of part of the 1980s, certainly into the 90s and into 2000, has been a catastrophic failure for the working class. and that there needs to be a recognition that it's not going to be enough to tinker around the edges, that structural changes, big changes to the system itself are going to have to be part of what the Democrats are going to do going forward if they're actually going to return some power to the working class.
Steve Phillips, let me get you here before
jobs,
the
better wages.
Yeah, Steve, can you go after that structure and carry identity politics at the same time? Can the Democrats walk and chew gum on this?
Yeah, the problem is that I think that there's some truth in what people are saying, but the challenge is that a colorblind approach is not going to deal with the fundamental problems that we face in our society, where you have a profound racial wealth gap in this country. The average white family has $140,000 in assets. The average black family has $11,000 in assets. It was perfectly legal to discriminate by race until 1964. Until you explicitly attack those challenges, you're not going to inspire voters of color to turn out in the race that they did that elected Obama.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Democrats rolling out a new appeal to American voters. They're calling it a better deal. They were in Berryville, Virginia yesterday. Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and a whole lot more. Elizabeth Warren saying, we are going to focus like a laser on the economy and people's real needs, are promising 10 million more jobs over 5 years, cracking down on monopolies and big corporate mergers, concrete action to lower the price of prescription drugs, $15 an hour minimum wage, and more. This is their sort of drum roll for the 2018 elections and beyond. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Are the Democrats getting back in the game here to win? And Trump voters, what do you see in what the Dems are putting out there? With Stephanie Kelton, she was an economic advisor to Bernie Sanders, also worked on this better deal policy agenda, economics professor at Stony Brook University. Steve Phillips is with us from the Center on America for American Progress, founder of Democracy in Color. And he's saying, wait a minute, don't forget, minorities who are really taking a hit here are taking a hit. Michael Sandel is with us, professor of political philosophy at Harvard University. He's been writing about this very, very interesting piece. You can link to it at our website, On Point Radio, that tries to find the roots of the populist fervor that we saw on the right and left in recent elections. He's not sure that they've quite got it here yet. They were rolling out the details and then talking about it here with Hakeem Jeffries, Democratic congressman from New York, one of the co-chairs of the House Democratic Policy and Communications Committee, explaining yesterday on CNN what's different about the Democrats' new better deal.
One is a recognition that things are broken in terms of what's happening with working families, middle class folks, those who aspire to be part of the middle class. Quite frankly, these folks are being screwed all across America by an economy that's not working for them. It's working for the wealthy and for the well-off.
And more to say here about what they now want to do. Hakeem Jeffries.
The productivity gains of the American worker are not going to the American worker. We're going to aggressively deal with that issue and confront wage stagnation. We're going to aggressively promote job creation and economic growth. We have a target of 10 million jobs. And we're also going to work hard to lower the everyday costs that the American people are experiencing, such as the out-of-control prescription drug prices.
A better deal, Democrats are calling it. Lots of people calling in to comment. Julie in Austin, Texas, thank you for calling, Julie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is Julie. I just want to know, you know, the new slogan, better deal. Better deal for who? I mean, I feel like, you know, the Democratic Party nowadays is pandering too much to the illegal, you know. I mean, I was a foot soldier for Don Kerry. I voted for Hillary Clinton in the primary, and then I voted for Barack Obama twice. But this time, I voted for Donald Trump because I feel like, you know, for better or for worse, he's going to protect my interests. You know, my wages haven't gone up. I mean, why would the company raise my wages when there are 11 million illegal willing to work for less?
Stephanie Kelton, what do you say to Julie in Texas?
I think that, you know, what Julie is saying is my wages haven't been going up. And what Donald Trump says is it's because of the Mexicans. And what I hope is going to become clear and what I hope the Democrats are going to do a better job of, frankly, going forward is helping voters to understand that it's not the Mexicans that are keeping your wages down. It's the bad trade deals. It's the concentration by big companies that don't have to pay you a higher wage because, quite frankly, you, the worker, need them more than they need you at this point. We have to have an economy that runs at full employment. We can engineer that. We can do that through good policy. And the
Julie says, why would they pay me more when they can hire undocumented labor, you know, right under my nose?
Corporations are swimming in profits, record profits. They have so much money they don't know what to do with it. So what do? They buy back their own shares. They pay dividends. They do, you know, stock buybacks and other kinds of things. But they don't have to pay Julie a higher wage, and that's the point. And what we have to do is shift power back to Julie and workers like her so that corporations, companies are forced to pay workers a higher wage. It's not because of the competition that's coming in from Mexico. That's the wrong that's the wrong place to be looking, Julie.
I mean, that's what Julie sees in Texas, but we're listening. One more, Josh in Livonia, Michigan. Josh, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
So Chuck Schumer is absolutely right when he says the Democratic Party is strong on economics, which is why I don't get why they're rolling out an entirely new economic plan. That's not what lost them the election. The problem is social and identity issues, and that's where moderates and independents feel like they're being left behind by the Democratic Party. And, you know, you have Donald Trump running on basically xenophobia, but also the people who, you know, are feeling alienated by the Democrats feel they have nowhere else to go.
Michael Sandel, we've got a big, diverse country. At one time, we celebrated this or liked to talk about celebrating it. 2016, Donald Trump did not celebrate it. He sort of the opposite, and he won. And you hear our caller saying, how do the Democrats address this? So he was straight up xenophobic in a lot of his comments, and he won followers with that.
Josh has a point. The Democrats, I think, are making a mistake if they think it's mainly about jobs, wages, and consumer prices. Donald Trump did invoke and appeal to xenophobia, but buried beneath that ugliness was a hunger for someone who would speak to national identity and pride. Now, the Democrats don't have to do it with xenophobia. But they do have to find a language of national community, national identity, what we owe one another as citizens. And connected to that, underlying Bernie's version of populism, his talk about money in politics and income inequality, was something bigger than economics. It was an implicit vision of democratic citizenship having been hollowed out. What troubles me about the Democrats' better deal,
mm-hmm.
and you see this even in the name of it, is that it is too transactional and rather than being aspirational. The larger aspirations embedded even in the ugliness of Trump's xenophobia and certainly in Bernie's protest against the role of big money in politics, the larger aspirations are to do with rearticulating a vision of national identity and pride, what we owe one another as citizens, and how we can give ordinary citizens a better, fuller voice at a time when our politics is dominated by big corporations, big money, and finance. I would suggest another focus, another slogan, if they want a slogan.
Okay, let's hear it.
Instead of a better deal, the question is, how can we give ordinary Americans a bigger voice? That suggests a larger civic project, a rethinking of democratic citizenship, how to empower and give voice to ordinary men and women who feel excluded by the economy, but also by the mainstream party's preoccupations with the professional classes and with big business and finance.
Steve Phillips, what about it? National community, identity, pride. Can you effectively put that out as a message that works for Democrats who also, historically, as you point out, bring in so many different sectors, ethnicities, races of society? Can national community work even at the same time as they reach out to the groups that you say don't leave behind?
Yes, but it has to be done in a way that is explicit about the full racial diversity and the cultural diversity of the country. And we can't bury our heads in the sand about the racial resentment that is being stirred up by Trump. Ron Brownstein had a great piece in The Atlantic recently about how Trump's appeal is rooted in a white nostalgia for a different era that previously existed. And what Obama did, both largely implicitly, but oftentimes explicitly, is he summoned America to a higher calling and explicitly said, let's all come together. He gave the race speech when he was running, when they were attacking his pastor. And he brought people to a point of saying that we're going to unite all racial groups in a common cause. In the State of the Union speeches, we do big things like universal health care, like tackling the country's challenges and problems. But the Democrats have been too muted and fearful to put forward that kind of a platform that explicitly tackles those issues, because frankly, they don't believe that enough white people will respond to that. But if you look at Obama's results, the numbers are that there is a consistent, meaningful minority of whites who want there to be racial justice in this country. When they are partnered with people of color, that's the majority of people in this country.
Stephanie, are these things in conflict? Can you go for national identity and still get everybody on the bus? Donald Trump went for a kind of identity which had a strong appeal to the sort of throwback era of white domination, I think you'd have to say. How do Democrats handle that and bring on board the diversity of their traditional base voter?
Yeah, I think, absolutely they can do that. And again, I think this is the kind of thing that Bernie did. When Senator Sanders goes out and gives these speeches and says, Donald Trump is trying to divide us up, we can't let that happen. And he would remind voters, we are all in this together. We have to be unified. We have to be one. We have to stand up with one voice and push back against the special interests. So he's, you know, in a sense, he's saying the 1%, right? We heard lots of focus on that. So that, for him, is the division. It's along economic, it's along class lines, but it's not, he was not going to sit back and quietly watch Donald Trump try to divide people up along racial and ethnic lines. And the Democrats, of course, can do that and maintain an economic message.
Paul in Valrico, Florida. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is so simple. By the time the Obama administration was winding down, a lot of Democrats were dissatisfied that he was too moderate. And the Democrats need to get out of that moderate ditch. I think the greatest political movement in the last 10 years is the one percenters. And I'd like to see the Democrats own that and let Elizabeth Warren be the voice for it, and let's really move ahead.
Let us pick it up right there. Stephanie, have the Democrats, are they resolving in this? What we've seen is a real conflict between the traditional triangulating Clinton centrists and what emerged as the sort of fervent Sanders following here. You were part of the Sanders effort. Is that somehow being resolved here? Does it speak to Paul's wish for less moderation and something more vivid?
Well, I think it does, at least to some extent. You know, it's only been a year and a half or so since Senator Sanders went out and demonstrated the kinds of success that someone can have with the kind of message, the bolder, more progressive sort of economic message, and the pushing back against the corrupt system and Elizabeth Warren with similar rhetoric. So I think it's going to take some time as Democrats continue to take on board those successes and to begin to, you know, as others test the water and show success, say, well, maybe, in fact, we can begin to move in a more progressive direction with some bolder sort of platform. But it's happening. It's just we're not quite there yet. I don't think we're prepared. I don't think the party as a whole is prepared to simply say, okay, you know, let's go with what the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders wing of the party does, and will abandon, you know, our old ways.
Michael Sandel, you point at something that sounds tough to me. You say Democrats have to kind of back off the meritocracy. They become, the professional membership of the Democratic Party has become too in love with its own standing and sense of achievement. Maybe that's a version of what Donald Trump was about. But what do you mean?
Well, by meritocracy, I mean the conviction, the faith, that those on top are there by dint of their own doing, their own merit, that their success is the measure of their virtue. Now, we slide into that very easily when we have a single-minded focus on perfecting equality of opportunity through job training and educational access and removing barriers to achievement so that people can reach as far as their talents and effort will take
them. You've heard Bill Clinton say this. You've heard Barack Obama say this.
It's become a reflex, a refrain, a slogan.
That seems like the American ideal, wasn't it?
In many ways it is, but that ideal, that slogan is ringing increasingly hollow because what it does, it puts its faith. It says we can live with inequality so long as people can rise.
Yeah.
Mobility. But the fact of the matter is that with greater inequality has come less mobility. Social, the ability to rise has hardened. It's easier to rise one generation to the next now in many countries of Europe.
Other countries. Other
than
countries.
It is in the United States. And so talk.
It's like talking a good game, but really trying to do it.
Yes.
Tough.
And it's interesting that Hillary and Barack Obama spoke constantly about fair opportunity. Neither Trump nor Bernie talked all that much about opportunity. Trump talked bluntly about winners and losers.
Yeah.
Bernie talked about inequality, dealing with inequality.
So what are they promising instead?
Well, I think that what the Democratic Party or Progressive Party should talk about instead of mobility is to deal directly with inequalities of income, wealth, and power.
You mean redistribution? What do you mean?
Well, to try to cultivate an ethic and to focus less on opportunity than on solidarity, on what we owe one another as fellow citizens. And that would be to recast many of these programs the Democrats are proposing, from health care to dealing with a minimum wage, not so much in terms of access to the fruits of consumption and the ability to rise, but instead in terms of how do we build together a deeper, more robust democratic citizenship, not just for the sake of consumption and prices and wages and our consumer identities.
Mm-hmm.
How can we make Americans feel that we are citizens again, engaged in a common project? That's the aspirational aspect that's missing from this agenda, this better deal.
Stephanie, are you going there, solidarity over opportunity, or is that a bridge too far?
No, I don't think it's a bridge too far. I think that, you know, that's exactly along the lines of what I think the Democrats ought to be doing. And, you know, I like very much the idea that Democrats should be moving away from this sort of rhetoric, ladders of opportunity, the idea that this is all a fair race. If we can just make it a fair race, then, you know, the inequality that results, well, you know, it is what it is. Who reaches the top first? Who reaches the top first? Instead of recognizing that the structural problems. The system is so rigged that some people are struggling to climb the ladder while others are on an escalator with an easier ride, and while a few others still take the elevator right to the top at birth.
Stephanie, we're out of time right there. I want to thank you at Stony Brook University for joining us. Steve Phillips, author of Brown is the New White in San Francisco. Michael Sandel out of Harvard, thanks so much for being with us today. The Democrats' plan, there it is. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Hi, I'm Ron Suskind.
And I'm Heather Cox Richardson.
We're the hosts of Freak Out and Carry On, a new politics and history podcast from WBUR.
Hey, thanks for sticking around for this preview from our show. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe to Freak Out and Carry On wherever you get your podcasts.
Take a listen to this excerpt. We chatted about Trump's approval ratings and historical parallels. And I guess my question is, when was the last time you had a president arrive into office and summon this sort of open, vigorous public protest?
Well, it was the presidency that everybody comes to first whenever they think about American history, and that was the presidency of Benjamin Harrison.
Oh, of course. I mean, the stage play, I love that, and the musical they did. It's fabulous, yeah.
Everyone always forgets about Benjamin Harrison, and there's a reason for that. He gets written out of history, but it was a very similar situation. A person who came to office after a Democratic president, Cleveland, who was popular among people who wanted reform, wanted to make sure the government government did not work just for the very wealthy. Harrison said that he would make some reforms, including to the tariff, did not win the popular vote, lost the popular vote by 100,000 votes. Gets put in with the Electoral College. As soon as he gets in, it's very clear that there's been hanky-panky going on. People are infuriated by that. They start to protest, and Harrison and his men keep saying, no, 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 we've got this. We know how to make America work again, how to bring the economy back, although it wasn't actually that bad right then. He puts his son into an important position and simply refuses to note that there is these protests going on, that people are literally starving out in the West. And he completely misses what's happening out West, which is, again, this huge protest that becomes the Alliance Movement of 1890, which takes over the House of Representatives by a margin of 2-1 that year and virtually flips the Senate. And Harrison is completely blindsided by it.
Right, and drives politics forward from that point. I mean, in a way, the reaction to Harrison becomes the defining thing of that
period.
That's
exactly right, and that's where we get the populist movement. And again, the progressive movement grows out of that at the turn of the next century.